Welcome to another episode of Conduct Detrimental. I am Dan Lust, and I'm joined this week by Dan Wallach. We are going to discuss once again the St. Louis Rams relocation lawsuit. Last week, we had one of our most popular episodes of all time, actually the most popular episode of all time. We had Ben Fisher on in the Sports Business Journal. So Dan and I put our heads together and we said, you know what? There is a growing demand for content on this particular lawsuit. So we wanted to serve our listeners well and cover this from a number of different perspectives. So we had Ben Fisher on. Ben works for the Sports Business Journal as their NFL beat reporter. You can call Ben maybe the voice of the NFL. He thinks like the NFL owners because he's covering them. So Dan and I said, you know what? We got to get two people here. We got to get to find someone that's been in the weeds of a lawsuit against the NFL, maybe has represented the NFL, and then maybe someone associated with St. Louis. So this week is the first of those topics. We found the perfect person, someone that's been in the weeds on the NFL side, also against the NFL, and has litigated a case on behalf of Oakland against the Raiders. And that's Jim Quinn, 40-year litigator at Weil Gotshal. Dan, I'm going to give you all the credit for this guest.
A little inside, scoop. I worked with Jim, and I say that term, loosely. I worked in the same building as Jim. 30 years ago, I began my legal career at Weil Gotshal & Manges as a litigator, working in the securities litigation and class action department. And I got to know Jeff Kessler and Jim Quinn very well. And those are two of the most transformative sports lawyers sort of in my lifetime. And Jim's work in the Freeman McNeil case led to unrestricted NFL free agency for the players. And more recently, he's representing the city of Oakland in an antitrust lawsuit against the NFL and against the 32 member teams, including the Las Vegas Raiders. And so many of the claims in the Oakland case mirror the claims that have been advanced in the St. Louis relocation lawsuit, to be sure. The breach of contract, the unjust enrichment claims, the disgorgement remedy predicated upon the reimbursement of the relocation fee and the increased franchise value. The same claims that are in St. Louis are also in the Raiders case, and Jim is litigating those claims, albeit to a little bit lesser success at this point because they've been knocked out by trial courts, and he's taking them up to the appellate court, and I believe he's going to prevail before the Ninth Circuit. So the NFL could be facing parallel lawsuits from two different municipalities utilizing the same legal theories. And of course, he also has an antitrust claim against the NFL as well. But it really, I think, would be enlightening to have a lawyer who's handling a similar case and creating almost an identical theory discuss the Oakland Raiders case and the parallels that it has to the St. Louis Rams relocation suit. And in my lifetime, as I said, this is like one of the legends of sports law, and it was such a lucky stroke to get him. So we have Jim Quinn today. So this is an episode that I'm really anxiously awaiting.
So you have Jim Quinn on, one of the legends of sports law. It's probably as good of a time to remind everyone that this podcast is sponsored by Themis Bar Review.
The legend of Bar Review preparation.
The legend of Bar Review preparation. So Jim Quinn got into it with him, but went to Fordham Law School once upon a time, as did myself. Great school. And, students that graduate from Fordham Law, they got to make a decision on who they're going to pick for their Bar Review company. Themis is a fantastic choice. Dan, I've had some conversations with our friends over at Themis. They're very happy with the response of our St. Louis Rams relocation episode, and they gave us the green light to hit this early and often, Dan. Isn't that great?
How would they not be happy? I mean, so many citizens in St. Louis are now going to go to law school. They're going to graduate, take Themis. And by the way, side note, I went to Fordham Law School too. I actually was one of the judges in the Fordham basketball negotiation competition. Does that count as going to Fordham?
No, it doesn't, Dan. That is a lie. You've been on the campus. Congrats, Dan.
Go back down memory lane a little bit. Do you know who invited me to be a judge?
This guy, the guy on the podcast with you right now. This is how Twitter networking works.
That's right.
Years ago.
2015, 2016. What I really loved about the Fordham experience, free hotel, loved it. Loved staying at that hotel. And it was a first-class experience, honest to God. You had already graduated, but that was one of the best sports law events that I've ever been to. And I repeated it back to back to back year. So I did that 3 years in a row. So that was my Fordham Law School interlude. But today we have somebody who just transcends Fordham, Hofstra, and the world of sports law. And just buckle in. If you're following the St. Louis Rams relocation lawsuit, you're going to want to listen to this interview, and in particular, what Jim Quinn says about your city's chances of getting an NFL franchise back should the city prevail at trial.
One final note before we get into the interview with Jim, and it's a fantastic discussion. You know, Dan and I were kicking around guests before we came to terms on with Jim, and Jim has got some great stories, and there's probably more stories for Jim to tell. But in the history of sports law, not many times do leagues go up against, or anybody goes up against the NFL and wins a trial. Dan and I spoke offline about this USFL lawsuit the last time. You know, the NFL maybe had a viable competitor, well, loose terms, unviable, but that was a great 30 for 30 on it. Donald Trump is credited for maybe bringing the downfall of USFL by deciding to compete directly against them. It was a lawsuit the USFL won, but congratulations, they won $3. They won a dollar, which was trebled to $3. So, you know, we actually bring that up to Jim on the podcast. Jim, I think we're on the same page here, but he said, you know who was responsible for the downfall? And, you know, people know the story, it's Donald Trump. But that just goes to say that was 30 years ago in the 1980s. And we really haven't had anybody put the screws to the NFL as we're seeing today. Jim's obviously doing it over in Oakland. And then on the other side of this, right, we're seeing it done in St. Louis. So, Dan, I wanted to bring this up to you. I was on San Diego radio this past week. I didn't know this, and I haven't been able to verify this independently. I was told that there was a settlement or some type of agreement between the city of San Diego and the Chargers, whereby they agreed not to sue for the efforts to relocate the team. Are you aware of any type of agreement like that?
No, I never heard about that. So what was the consideration in exchange for the covenant not to sue? What was San Diego promised?
That's a good, I'm not sure of the answer. Somebody told me this kind of on the record, off the record. I won't say who it was, but here's the question. Three teams decided to move in 2016. The Raiders, the Rams, who we're going to talk about a lot in this podcast, and the Chargers. Two of which resulted in lawsuits. Why aren't the San Diego Chargers embroiled in some type of lawsuit, either that's ongoing or it's been dismissed? Why don't we have anything like that?
Well, and it's interesting. They're a tenant in the Los Angeles Rams new facility, and they've got the best quarterback of the three teams, and they could be potentially a candidate for another relocation to a city that wants to attract an NFL franchise, because that team, that franchise, is set up for a long time with a quarterback like Justin Herbert, one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL. San Diego has less than a desirable situation in Los Angeles right now. The Chargers do. I mean, I don't mean San Diego. They could very well play the relocation game once more to go to a city like Austin and San Antonio. So the world of litigation around relocation, it's just like a merry-go-round. It's going to be 1 year, it's going to be St. Louis and Oakland. A year or 2 years from now, it could be Jacksonville or Buffalo. This is never going to end unless the NFL does something to change its policies and to be fair to some of the cities. And it may take an antitrust verdict from the city of Oakland to cause that kind of seismic change.
One thing I'll take issue with, not your legal analysis, your sports analysis. I think as of 2021, I'd rather have Matt Stafford at the helm than Justin Herbert. Matt Stafford, obviously quarterback with the Rams. But for the next 10 years, no brainer. You take the young guy in Herbert.
Dan, that's why you're not a general manager, and that's why you're a lawyer. And at Garagos and Garagos, nobody in their right mind would not take Herbert over Stafford. And
for
Stafford,
this year?
Great quarterback.
For this year?
For any year. He's already...
So, Dan, we'll talk about this off the podcast, but we'll agree to disagree.
With three games in.
Matt Stafford already on his career, if he retired tomorrow, there's still a conversation that he's a Hall of Fame quarterback. Herbert's done it for all but 1 year, so I'm going to have to see it more to believe that. You know, obviously Herbert's super talented. He's got a tremendous arm, but Stafford's been a Hall of Fame quarterback with a horrendous team around him for years, and now he's finally in Los Angeles. He's, I think last I checked, number three in the odds to win the MVP. Herbert is not, he's not at that caliber yet. So we'll see. But Herbert's got to do it for more than a season before I'm going to say he's better than Stafford.
Let me bookmark and date stamp this part of the conversation.
Go ahead, sports betting guru. I'll go toe-to-toe with you on NFL knowledge. So anyway, Jim Quinn was fantastic. We mentioned 40 years at Weil Gotshal. He's now of counsel. His book, Don't Be Afraid to Win. He's going to talk about a couple stories from that. Before we get into Jim, again, this podcast is sponsored by Themis Bar Review. We talk about all elements really of contract law in this podcast and elements of fraud. And there's probably no better place to learn about contractual elements, fraud, unjust enrichment, appeals, choice of venue than at Themis Bar Review, the top bar review prep company in the entire world. Hard stop, hard pause. Dan, we ready to go to Jim Quinn?
Yes, let's take it to Jim Quinn. Our audience has been waiting long enough, and he has some explosive things to say about the St. Louis case. We are honored to welcome to Conduct Detrimental one of the most impactful sports trial lawyers of our time. I worked with him literally in the same building, but not with him, 30 years ago. Jim Quinn, the longtime head of the litigation practice at Weil Gotshal, and now of counsel with Bergen and Droffy, 40 years at Weil Gotshal. Biggest mistake I ever made as a lawyer early on was not trying to get into your practice. I decided to go to work for Dennis Block instead. It took me 30 years to recover from that. So welcome to Conduct Detrimental, Mr. Quinn.
I'm glad to be here.
Over the last couple of weeks, Dan and I have been following the St. Louis Rams relocation lawsuit very closely because the court in St. Louis denied summary judgment. And now it's gotten on the national radar again. It's going to head to trial. But so many of the issues and claims that are at issue in the St. Louis Rams case are common to a case that you've been handling out in the California federal and state courts, which is the city of Oakland's lawsuit over the relocation of the Oakland Raiders to Las Vegas. And there are two components to that. You have the state law claims that are similar to the St. Louis Rams case, but you also have a federal antitrust lawsuit as part of that. Can you tell us where the cases are at this point? And as a trial lawyer, I know you're eager to get to trial. Where does that stand today? And what are the prospects that we're going to have two cases going to trial?
Sure. We originally filed the lawsuit on behalf of the city of Oakland against the NFL and the other owners relating to the move of the Raiders to Las Vegas. And that lawsuit had two prongs to it. One was the antitrust claim, essentially saying that the owners had conspired in a way to allow the move and only essentially to benefit themselves since they managed to split almost $360 million in so-called relocation fees, essentially leaving the city of Oakland holding the bag. The second part of that lawsuit, which is the one that's analogous to the claims that are going forward in St. Louis, are contract claims relating to the NFL's relocation policy. We also argued that we were third-party beneficiaries under the relocation policies. The case was originally in federal court. The magistrate judge sitting as the district court dismissed the federal claims, which are now on appeal in the Ninth Circuit. That claim has been argued, and we're hoping to get a decision shortly within the next month or so. We think that the appeal argument went well. We'll see what happens. The federal court judge decided not to make a final ruling with regard to the contract claim, saying that once he had dismissed the antitrust claim, which is the basis for jurisdiction in federal court, that he no longer used his discretion essentially to say that he was not going to and need not determine the contract claims. So we thereafter filed a separate lawsuit in state court in Los Angeles based on the state claims, those claims being very analogous to the claims that are now looks like going to trial in St. Louis. That, not surprisingly, the NFL moved to dismiss. And those claims were also thrown out and are on appeal to the state court appeals. And we are moving forward with those appeals probably over the next few months. So right now, everything's on appeal in California. We're hoping that we'll get some reversals. Obviously, the decision on summary judgment in St. Louis should help us in the California state case, since the arguments are virtually identical, although obviously the law, one is under the law of Missouri and one is under the law of California, although those laws do not on the face of it appear to be largely different. So that's where things stand as of right now.
Okay, what's the core of the antitrust claim having to do with the NFL limiting the supply of Marcus?
Exactly. Basically, the idea is that the NFL has intentionally, over the course of its existence, but certainly in the last 20 years, limited the number of teams. And the reason they do that, and this is really the guts of the antitrust issue, is the reason they do that is in order to be able to essentially decide when they want where teams will be, and essentially leaving cities like Oakland, which are supposedly protected by their relocation policies, holding the bag if the team wants to move. And one of the great ironies of this is when a team moves, it has to pay all the other owners to move, and they split the money. It's a neat little trick.
Let's get to the relocation fee for a second, because that infuses your contract claims. How do you view the relocation fee? I mean, the Giants aren't going to appropriate another market. So is this a bribe? Is it something? What is the ostensible purpose of the relocation fee other than to line the pockets?
The essential purpose is to align the pockets of the NFL. The excuse they use is, and this is kind of a bizarre excuse, is that it's a question of, well, lost opportunity, because otherwise they would have the opportunity to put a team in, say, Las Vegas. They're basically saying, we own America, and therefore we're going to charge anybody if they want to move from one part of America to another part of America. It's something of a gambit.
I want to spend a lot of time talking about St. Louis, but I want to sort of, for our audience sake and for my own sake, get a better understanding of where the judge didn't see eye to eye with your claims on the antitrust level. I mean, the NFL can't have 100 teams. It can't have 50 or 60 teams. What's the argument, though, that limiting it to 32 constitutes an antitrust violation?
Well, the argument is that by limiting it to 32 and then using that limit in order to extract, in this case, super competitive prices by going to Oakland and saying, listen, you either put up $2 billion for a new stadium, we're going to move the team. It's essentially competitive extortion. And whether or not you're looking at the market in Oakland or you're looking at the market in Las Vegas, they are, by limiting the number of teams, they are extracting monopoly profits.
What we found interesting, and obviously we've kind of looked at the history of these relocation policies. I'm sure we're going to have more questions for you once we kind of turn over to the St. Louis conversation.
Sure.
But, you know, it was about 25 years ago, the city of Baltimore gained a team at the expense of Cleveland, right? And I've read some of your papers and some of your comments on this discussion, but it was a question of, you know, was there some type of agreement under the table that, hey, Cleveland, you're going to lose your team here, but, you know, if you guys do everything right and you jump through these hoops, we'll give you an expansion team. We'll replace the Browns. And obviously the Browns were replaced with the new Browns. You know, is there a reason that that type of conversation isn't occurring at this point? Is that, you know, maybe a portion of your claim? Like, we're just now all of a sudden stuck at 32 in the history of the NFL. We've never been stuck at a number. We've always kind of incrementally gone up. If it's the Jaguars and the Panthers or the Texans, is there anything different this time around that's preventing expansion?
Well, one of the arguments that they would make, and it's not completely irrational, is that every time they expand, they also have to share all of the revenue that they get from network television and the other new revenue streams. So there's a tension in terms of whether or not they can expand. But it's pretty clear that we have economists who've looked at this, but there have been dozens of economists who could say easily the NFL could have as many as 48 teams and it would not have an impact. And remember, now every time they sell a team, it used to be a team would maybe buy $50 million, then it was $400 million. Now it's $2.5 to $3 billion. That money just goes into the pockets of the other owners. So from their economic standpoint, they have to make that decision. But what we're saying in our case is they're utilizing the limited supply of teams in order to extort from cities monopoly revenue.
And I think just one final point, at least my vantage point, for background purposes, I'm sure people that are listening to this are aware. I think it was 2016 when the Rams, the Chargers and the Raiders all applied to move to Los Angeles. It was kind of trifecta who's going to move first. And obviously of those three teams, two of which, the Chargers and the Rams, got to move to Los Angeles. And the third, the Raiders, got to move to Las Vegas. For your purposes, Jim, I don't think it matters where they moved, Las Vegas or Los Angeles. But, you know, certainly to your last point, we had a period of football when you had the Los Angeles Rams and the Los Angeles Raiders, both teams left to go to, I guess, you know, I'm going to say this, my words, lesser markets, be it Oakland and St. Louis. But I think you're pointing out something very interesting. Maybe within the last 6 months, a piece of the Golden State Warriors, just coincidentally another California team, I think a portion of the team was sold at a valuation that would value, you know, 100% of the pie at $5 billion. So I think owners are getting smarter. The more we kind of limit the demand, or the supply, the demand will increase. And that'll only just increase the price of these organizations. So, you know, people ask, why haven't we seen these lawsuits before? And I think to your point, Jim, and in your papers, because the cap on teams is all of a sudden being depressed in a way it's never really been before. Is that kind of the way that you're seeing it?
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly how we see it. And, you know, look, from the league's economic standpoint, I understand that it all makes sense. That means they can make a lot more money, but it doesn't make it legal.
Jim, I was watching the oral argument in the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals, and the questioning seemed to be hung up on the issue of, you know, causation, standing under the antitrust law, standing under Article 3. Did the judge, the magistrate judge, wanted or expected a showing that there would be a team willing to relocate to Oakland? Is that really was the basis of the decision and the oral argument?
I think wrongly, though, I think that was something that was stuck in his head. I think we made a compelling case that is not necessary under current precedent, that you need to show that there is, in fact, another team out there. I mean, when you look at it conceptually, nobody is going to put together a franchise without knowing that they can get into the NFL. And the NFL they're the gatekeeper. So it's not like any rational person is going to sit down. Bill Gates is not going to go out and hire the best college football players and build his own stadium with all his own money and then apply hat and hand to the NFL and say, oh, please let me in.
On that point, Dan, I mean, we just saw a billionaire maybe attempt to do that, be it Vince McMahon with the XFL. And how did that go for him, right? It was kind of a failed venture. So we haven't seen someone do that in the last 30, 40 years since the USFL. Right? That's really the only NFL, anyone that's come close to competing with the NFL.
Yeah, and we know who torpedoed the USFL.
Dan has some thoughts on that as well. We almost had him on for a guest as well. But obviously, you know, it comes with the territory.
Well, Jim, in my spare time professionally, I represent sports betting companies. And so as a sports betting attorney, I'll tell you that that Ninth Circuit oral argument went very well for you. And if I was a betting man, I think some of these claims are going to get reinstated. So assuming that there's a reversal and a remand, you're going to be faced with a choice. You have federal claims, and then you have state law claims that are similar to the St. Louis lawsuit that have been dismissed, but you're pursuing a state court appeal. Would you consider merging the state law claims and the federal claims back in a federal court action, because that might be the quicker path instead of waiting for the state appeals panel to decide the case months from now?
Well, I'm certainly that's something that we would look at. One of the things we have to evaluate on a practical level is the judges that are going to handle the case. And so we'll make that a game day decision if in fact there's a reversal.
Let's focus on the NFL's relocation policy, because the parallel issues in both Oakland and the St. Louis cases is that the relocation policy is a contract and that municipalities are third-party beneficiaries to the relocation policy. Why is that so when it wasn't negotiated between two parties operating at arm's length and it was just a sort of a policy that was created out of whole cloth solely by the NFL? Why is that a contract and why does that benefit municipalities under a third party beneficiary theory?
Well, that's a fair question, but you have to go back to look at the history of how the relocation policies came about, because in fact, the relocation policies were actually a response to what happened back in the 80s with regard to the Oakland moving back and forth between Oakland and Los Angeles. And there was an effort back then by people in Congress, including a couple of senators, to actually pass bills in Congress that would restrict the NFL's ability to allow teams to move and would thereby protect the host cities. As you go through the history of it, it turns out that those relocation policies were negotiated between the NFL and a group of mayors of cities around the country. So it's a bit of a falsity to say that they weren't really negotiated. They actually were, because the cities who were potential victims of the NFL's relocation policies went to the NFL and said, listen, we're going to support these bills in Congress, which will take away your ability to relocate franchises unless you come up with policies that are going to protect us. I assume that will come out during the course of the trial in St. Louis.
I read through some of the archives in the early 1980s when the Oakland Raiders were suing the NFL. I guess those were some of the earlier antitrust cases which gave rise to the relocation policy. I think it was Pete Rozelle who said that the relocation policy was designed to protect home markets. Either it was Rozelle that said that or it was in the briefing in the Ninth Circuit case. I just remember reading that somewhere.
There were a number of NFL executives. I don't recall whether it was Rozelle himself, but one or more of his subalterns made it clear that the reason for these relocation policies was to protect the home cities.
See, I guess on that, and this is where on our last podcast, we dug a little bit into. So 4.3, I'm just going to read what I think the relevant language is here. Article 4.3 also confirms that no club has a, quote, entitlement to relocate simply because it perceives an opportunity for enhancing club revenues in another location. Indeed, league traditions disfavor relocations if a club has been well-supported and financially successful and is expected to remain so. You know, relocation pursuant to Article 4.3 may be available, however, if a club's viability in its home territory is threatened by circumstances that cannot be remedied by diligent efforts of the club working, and it goes on. This is kind of where the two lawsuits, I think there's an interesting comparison. We haven't spoke about this, Jim, but I know we know it on the St. Louis level. Do you know what efforts Oakland, you know, the city of Oakland was making to try to retain the team?
They had put together a group that was prepared to assist the city in building what would have been $1.5, $1.6 billion new stadium. And basically the NFL just backhanded that and said, we don't really think this is viable and we're going to let the Raiders move. Now, if you think about it, the league and the other owners get nothing if the team stays in Oakland. On the other hand, the team moves, two things happen. One, the Raiders themselves' value of the team skyrockets, which is what's happened already. And secondly, the other owners get to split, you know, nearly $400 million, which even for them is not a pittance.
See, there's a conversation that's occurring at the NBA level in basketball because they were hit hard from the COVID season, the pandemic season, probably worse than anybody else because the pandemic happened in the middle of their season. The Super Bowl had just happened, so it didn't hurt the NFL as much in terms of games.
Right.
But the NBA has had a very kind of transparent conversation that, hey, we might need to consider expansion in order to kind of fix the revenue problem, to fix the salary cap. And that's, Jim, to your point exactly, right? They're thinking of maybe expanding into Las Vegas or back into Seattle where the Supersonics were to replace that revenue. And everyone's saying, yeah, because somebody might pay us $500 million for a franchise. So I think for the listeners, obviously we understand it, but that's why all 32 NFL owners are named as both of these lawsuits because of the alleged, I think you, in your words, right, the cartel of the NFL. You're kind of shaking down one city or you're shaking down the new city. And I think you explained it well, right? In this scenario of this kind of three-person dance, maybe we can say Las Vegas lost because they had to pay an exorbitant fee. Oakland lost because they lost their team. And who wins in this, right? The Raiders franchise, but also the NFL, right? The other NFL owners. And I think that's a really important conversation here, that there are two losers in this, the potential new team or a new city that's going to, and obviously the old one. So when we've been explaining this case to people that maybe aren't as familiar, this lawsuit and this case is not just relevant to, you know, Oakland. It's not just relevant to St. Louis, but it's relevant to any potential market that might want a team at some point.
Or wants to protect the team like Buffalo or Jacksonville, because I think it's fair to say that those teams are potentially in play. And so, you know, we'll have to wait and see what happens. But yeah, this has a far-ranging impact.
I'll take one more on this topic. So we spent a lot of time, you know, in the St. Louis case, because obviously this one is still, you know, kicking around in the trial court level prior to the appeal.
Sure.
You know, the question is whether or not the relocation policies constitute some sort of a contract, okay? And if they do, right, if the offer was definitive and everyone's going to say they were bound by it, which I'm not sure, I think you can come out both ends of it. I think it's a much more clear question, and people can disagree with me. I don't understand how you read the relocation guidelines and not take away that the home market was an intended third-party beneficiary. Dan had this tweet out the other day that I think, Dan, what is it? Home markets were referenced like 40 times in the document in some way, shape, or form?
40 plus times, and then designated and classified as an interested party, as well as the publication and newspaper. It's almost akin to what happens with, like, you know, zoning approvals where, you know, anyone in the neighborhood is designated as an interested, you know, party. They get notice of the proposal. It just sounds so much like it was intended to elevate the city and the stadium authority to some exalted level beyond just a mere taxpayer.
Certainly our view. There is also, I believe at one point, they actually talk about it's the obligation of the local team to do these things. When you talk about an obligation, that sounds like a contractual commitment.
Right. And I think just on this point, right, you mentioned Buffalo and Jacksonville. You know, I think you'd kind of be living under a rock if you didn't think that, hey, maybe there's some sense of security if Buffalo, residents of Buffalo, city of Buffalo, Jacksonville, they look at this and they say, hey, these teams can't move. You know, if we make diligent efforts and the team's well supported, the team can't move. That's essentially, I think, a fair reading of 4.3. But in the St. Louis case, and as is being argued in your case as well, the NFL is reading it that, hey, we're allowed to do whatever we want. This is a guiding principle. This actually means nothing, and we can go ahead and do whatever we want. We don't even have to abide by this. What are your thoughts overall on the NFL's argument that this is not intended to benefit these home states, that it just, hey, we put this out there, the public can see it, but it really has no ramifications on anything?
If I was, you know, a betting person, I would bet on the plaintiffs in the St. Louis case. In front of a jury, I don't think that that's a particularly persuasive argument to basically see, oh, we created this thing, but really means nothing and we can do whatever we want. I think jurors are not likely to accept that, particularly given the summary judgment decision, which is going to reflect at least to some degree how the jury instructions are ultimately written for that jury to make a determination.
I think the concern with the St. Louis jury is that they may go too far unless properly instructed. And I've been focusing the last couple of weeks on the disgorgement remedy. That's a big part of your lawsuit, and that's a big part of the St. Louis lawsuit, disgorging the NFL of its, in your case, it was a $300 million some odd dollar relocation
fee.
In St. Louis, it was $550 million.
Right.
And then, of course, both franchises' valuations have gone up significantly due to the move to so-called, you know, bigger market. I think in St. Louis, the Forbes valuation went from $1.5 billion in 2017 to today, $4.8 billion, which is more than $3 billion. A lot of that obviously is going from St. Louis to Los Angeles. There's going to be a debate, or at least an issue for an appellate court to consider, as to whether disgorgement of those types of sums are proper compensatory damages under a breach of contract theory, and whether it's proper measure of damages for unjust enrichment. Because when I think of unjust enrichment, I'm thinking normally of the value of the benefit that the plaintiff confers upon the defendant. If I go to your house and cut your grass and you don't pay me and there's a quasi contract, I guess I should get paid the value of the services that I rendered. Why should the city of Oakland and the city of St. Louis end up potentially in a better position had the wrong not occurred?
It's a good question. I think it's a close question, but I do think that there's a decent argument that says that, and certainly in the context of the antitrust claim, given the fact that they are, as a result of what they've done, whether or not under the contract or whether under the antitrust, they've ended up with a huge windfall. Under those circumstances, there's an argument that says that the windfall has to come back.
Under an unjust enrichment theory?
Yes. And, yeah, okay. Unjust enrichment.
I get that point. And I think Missouri law differs from California law in several respects, because the unjust enrichment theory under Missouri law doesn't track the value of the benefit that the plaintiff confers upon the defendant. It's the unjust gain that was sort of derived at the expense of the plaintiff. So I can see that happening in Missouri.
I think you are right that the law is somewhat different. I think it's probably more of an uphill battle in California than it is in Missouri.
How are punitive damages going to play out in both California and Missouri? I've been, you know, as a former commercial litigator, I'm very familiar with the Campbell Supreme Court decision and punitive damages up to a multiple or a ratio of 9 to 1, you know, single digit is, you know, sort of comports with due process. Is this going to be the lion's share of the damages that could get awarded in both cases, should they both go to trial and a jury sides with the cities?
Well, I think there is a difference here, because obviously in the antitrust case, there's treble damages. So that's a different kettle of fish. In our contract case, we don't have any tort claims. So we don't have a punitive damage claim in the contract case. In St. Louis, however, there are tort claims that have survived. And particularly if the fraud claim survives, it seems to me that there's a decent chance that a jury is going to award significant punitive damages.
Well, speaking of the various remedies available, during the oral argument in front of the Ninth Circuit, one of the panelists mentioned something about injunctive relief. Now, you're an attorney who, over the course of your career, has basically created these transformative remedies for professional athletes. I mean, your involvement in the Freeman McNeil case led to unrestricted free agency. In the city of Oakland case, at this point, you're only asking for monetary damages, maybe treble damages. Is there a possibility, or is there a viable pathway to injunctive relief? What would it look like? And two, is the sort of the eminent domain road completely closed for municipalities going forward? Because I know that that was an issue 20, 30 years ago in the first city of Oakland case.
Yeah, just to answer that, I think the eminent domain issue is kind of a dead issue, not just in sport. It's just a very, very difficult argument. And on the other hand, with regard to the injunctive relief, obviously we've been focusing on damages. We don't expect that even if we win that suddenly the Raiders are going to come back. There's too much that would have to be undone. But we could certainly get an order basically directing the NFL and its teams to follow the relocation policies under an order that they are, in fact, a contract.
Let's look forward to the reversal and remand. You're sitting looking over in Missouri, and the plaintiff's attorneys have taken boatloads worth of depositions. How eager are you to get your hands on those transcripts and those discovery materials? And how easy will it be for you to obtain those for use in the California case? Because I'm sure there's going to be, you know, sort of gold in those transcripts.
Well, yeah, look, we obviously jumped on the opportunity in part because it would save us a lot of time and money, not having to redo a lot of the work that's already been done by the lawyers in St. Louis. I think we could eventually, if we're successful, we will be able to get our hands on those things, because I think the court in California is going to direct the NFL to produce that in order, if nothing else, to save time here. We saw your judge, you know, we can we can save a lot of time and money if just direct them, give us all the stuff in the St. Louis case.
You mentioned it quickly, and I guess as we were, again, kind of like looking forward, you mentioned this nugget. I made sure I wrote it down. You said you like the chances of the plaintiff with the respect to a St. Louis jury. I think I heard you say
yes,
that.
Yes, you did.
I would think so, too. I would think so, too. A little bit of home
very,
cooking.
Yeah. Obviously have the element of home cooking, but it's also a very attractive case. I believe there's actually a reasonable chance that that case may settle before it goes to trial, because I think the NFL is going to have a difficult time putting on fact witnesses in order to defend themselves.
Now, you would know as the head of the litigation department at Walt Gottschall for 40 years that 99.9% of cases find a way to settle. It's just a matter of when. We thought that would be maybe problematic here because of the amount of controversy.
It is a lot of money. And the NFL have traditionally been willing to go to trial. On the other hand, given the threat of punitive damages, let's assume that you got a big judgment and then on top of it, you put punitive damages, that could be a big payday for the plaintiffs.
I've been theorizing that if that's the end game and the jury awards punitive damages, it could set up the city of St. Louis for potential negotiations to get a franchise back in St. Louis.
Oh, absolutely. No question.
Really, you're that bullish on that, because I put that out there and people were saying, oh, come on. And I said, look, if you tack on punitive damages to those disgorgement remedies as actual damages, that easily gets up to $10, $15 billion. And now it's a conversation starter to put a team back in St. Louis. Explain why you think that that's so, other than the obvious way to, you know, compromise a big multi-billion dollar tab. It makes so much sense to me.
Well, I think it's so because the NFL, the owners are practical. And if it means that they can pay a lot less and give the city of St. Louis a franchise, it's really not a big deal to them. It just means that they have to share more. St. Louis has had two teams already. It's not like it's never been an NFL market. It's been an NFL market twice.
And still they have, you know, the St. Louis Blues, St. Louis Cardinals, they're still a robust sports city. Jim, in the remaining time we have, you know, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about your history in the sports law space. As people know your background, you've represented all four of the North American sports leagues, you know, the core four, and you've negotiated the first free agent contract in all of sports?
Well, the first free agency deal that was done came as a result of the Oscar Robertson case in 1976. Which was my first case in sports. I mean, obviously, I wasn't the lead then. I was a child. That was a case that led to the first free agency, almost simultaneously with free agency in baseball, which happened shortly after. And then I was involved later in football in the free agency trial that led to free agency in football.
Your book, Don't Be Afraid to Win, is out now. If you can, I know you've had 40 years of war stories on the legal side and obviously specifically on the sports law side. Any stories you care to share from us from the book or otherwise during your practice? We have a lot of law students, young lawyers that listen to this as well.
There are a lot of stories, some funny and some serious. One of the more interesting ones was how we came about agreeing to the first salary cap in 1982 in basketball. And just to give you a very executive summary of it, at that point, it's hard to believe now, but at that point, the NBA was suffering significantly from financial downturn. They, of course, blamed it on players making too much money, as they always do. But one of the things that happened was for years, whenever they would cry poor, we would always ask them to show us their financial statements. And they would always refuse. And then we'd say, OK, well, that's obviously they're lying and it can't possibly be the case that they are, in fact, having financial troubles. So we go to the first negotiation session in 1982, and David Stern is there as the deputy commissioner. He had not quite become commissioner yet, but he was kind of running the show for the NBA. In David's own inimical way, he walks in, he's got big stacks of files. I think there were 27 teams at the time, and he walked in with 27 files, and he pointed to them and said, you know, you want to see our financials? Now you can see our financials. And sure enough, we went in and we looked at their financials. And in fact, there were five or six teams that were virtually bankrupt, another half dozen that were on the verge of bankruptcy. And we finally sat down and looked at each other and said, we got to do something. And that's what led to the first salary cap.
Was it always intended to last in perpetuity? Because I think once that door opened,
In fact, a few years later, we tried to get rid of it. And once they had it, it was something that they were never, ever going to give up. On the other hand, who knew back then that by tying the size of the cap to revenue, that it would turn out that now you've got an average salary in the NBA of something close to $10 million a year. When at the first salary cap, the entire salary cap for the first year in 1984 was $3.5 million per team. So it's gone up a bit as a result by tying it to revenues. The players have done okay, notwithstanding the fact that there is a salary cap.
It would have been nice to tie that to franchise value increases because...
Yes, there's no question about it. Fact of a salary cap, and that's been true in all of the sports that have a salary cap, it has led to an explosion in franchise values. And one way or the other, I would personally like to get a check either from the owners or from the players. I should have taken a percentage.
Well, interestingly, to Dan's point, and then we'll get you out, you know, we had this conversation in this past year. All of these teams, right, in terms of revenue, they're saying we lost money during the pandemic. It's a conversation, you know, that's going to occur at the Major League Baseball's collective bargaining agreement negotiation in a couple months. I mean, I'm looking at the Forbes valuations. It doesn't look like any team was harmed.
No, valuations have not gone down. And that's because if you have a monopoly, it's always a monopoly. It's a good thing.
It was certainly a pleasure having you on our show, and hopefully we can have you back on as this case progresses. Obviously, your case progresses over in the Ninth Circuit. Dan, anything else to add?
No. I would just be willing to turn over the reins of Conduct Detrimental for one episode to Jim and to Jeff Kessler to tell all those war stories of their years fighting the NFL. I once sat in on a luncheon at Weill Gotshal where you guys did that in the early 1990s. It was riveting stuff, and I would just love to hear some of those stories about how you transformed the business of the NFL and free agency.
Sure. I'm sure Jeff and I would love to do it.
All right.
That's a binding contract if I've ever seen one.
And our audience is the intended third-party beneficiary. You're on. Jim, thank you so much. This was such an enlightening, you know, conversation, and we loved having you. Thank you for all your time and for all your efforts to advance the cause of sports law and players' rights all these years.
That's great. I loved being with you, and hopefully we'll see you guys again.
All right.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Jim. Have a great day.
You too.
Dan, that was quite the interview. Did you hear what I heard, that Jim might be predicting a team coming to St. Louis?
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense economically. I've been putting it out there with some of my interviews and tweets. But, I mean, let's face it, bottom line, the NFL and the 32 teams are going into a hornet's nest in front of a St. Louis jury. And if a St. Louis jury awards disgorgement remedies of the relocation fee and the increased franchise value and then tax on punitive damages of up to 10 to 1, you're looking at a price tag of $10 billion, $15 billion easily. I mean, this is before we consider an appeal, but when you're able to recover that level of damages, that begins a conversation for how do you resolve the lawsuit? The NFL is not going to want to write a check for $10 to $15 billion. That begins a conversation about putting a franchise back in the city of St. Louis. And I can tell you, of all the episodes we've done, none have generated the kind of enthusiasm and interest of the St. Louis relocation lawsuit. St. Louis is a viable NFL market. You can just feel it from all the engagement we're getting on our podcasts, on our Twitter feeds, on our tweets. I think that's a conversation starter for placing a team back in St. Louis. So if the team wins the case, or if the city wins the case, that has to be something that goes on the table. And it's one thing for you and me to talk about it, Dan, and we're theorizing. Jim's been in the trenches and been in the battles, and he's been in the war rooms negotiating with people like David Stern and the NFL commissioner. If Jim Quinn says that it's not a big deal to place a team back in St. Louis once the city has that kind of leverage as a result of a final judgment, you got to take it from someone like Jim Quinn that's a viable outcome.
You and I, and I went on shows this past week because I know you did, and we both kind of have of this opinion. Maybe the decision that was incorrect by the judge in the St. Louis case was not transferring the venue outside of St. Louis. And I think, Jim, we kind of joked on the interview, right? Home cooking, right? You take the case to a St. Louis jury, what do you expect is going to happen, right? The betting odds have to be in favor of St. Louis. Maybe the case gets overturned on appeal. Is that certainly possible? Yes, but I don't think, and if you're a betting man, Dan, you're the sports betting guru, you're an appellate lawyer, you're the perfect one to set these odds, right? I still don't think the you can assume that something is going to be overturned on appeal, even though that we think that decision's wrong. It's a lot of, you know, you're putting all of your eggs in that particular basket. And I think to Jim's point, his history, and we talked about it a little bit, Cleveland lost a team. The team went from Cleveland and they became the Baltimore Ravens. And all of a sudden, there was an expansion team that popped up in Cleveland. And the NFL kind of brought them back. And that was the Tim Couch era of Cleveland Browns football. And they had these horrendous quarterbacks over the years. But football came back. Same deal with I believe the last expansion team in the NFL was the Houston Texans. The Houston Oilers went over to be the Tennessee Titans. And that team was replaced. So kind of have to ask yourself, why is there this long lull of teams or cities suing the NFL because, hey, you relocate, you took our team out? Because there has been, you know, there's no conversation about expanding the NFL to 33, 34, 35, 36 teams. The thing I took away what Jim said, and I'm not privy to these economist studies. There's been studies out there that the NFL could have 48 teams and still be a viable league. And that's maybe Jim's argument to say, hey, you are unlawfully restraining, you know, relocation. And why are you doing it? Because to Jim's point, and this is the same argument that's being occurring at the St. Louis level, because if you drive down the amount of teams in the league and you keep it at 32, the only thing that's going to go up is this relocation fee, right? So maybe it was $50 million before, but now we're getting numbers that are in the almost half a billion. And that number is being driven up because the amount of teams is going up. And Dan, you raised this great point right at the end of our conversation. I wish we had another hour with Jim, honestly. You know how fascinating it is that in the history of leagues, we tie the salary cap to revenue. Can you imagine how different this lawsuit would be if we tied the salary cap to team valuation? That would be a completely different conversation.
Yeah, I mean, you see repeatedly the NFL bases its whole economic, all the leagues base their economic model and relationships with players on revenues. Yet the values of the franchises go up exponentially because there's a finite number of them. And, you know, they now are, you know, attracting multi-billion dollar sale prices, none of which is shared with the players or included within, you know, basketball related income, football related income for purposes of calculating the salary cap. Certainly some part of the increased valuation of sports franchise should be factored into the, you know, sort of the labor negotiations for what players should be compensated. Because regardless of P&Ls, teams dramatically increase in franchise values and the cost goes up, if not exponentially, just rather dramatically. So that was a really interesting takeaway. But for me, when I look at the NFL's approach to how they might look at settlement negotiations post-verdict, you got to be absolutely out of your mind if you're the National Football League to get socked with a $10-plus billion verdict and think that you're going to get it overturned on appeal following a jury verdict. Certainly, there may be some issues about the excessiveness of some of the damages, but to this point, the trial court has affirmed or upheld the viability of these state law claims as well as the damage theories. And the Missouri appellate courts have also briefly weighed in on some of the issues in this case, and they never once took umbrage or issue with the damage recovery theory. So for the NFL to think that they're going to be on the losing end of a $10 to $15 billion verdict, inclusive of punitive damages, and then roll the dice before the Missouri appellate courts, following a jury verdict where appellate courts tend to be deferential to findings made by juries, I don't think that's a sensible way for the National Football League to approach it. But if that's the situation that the league finds itself in, I could easily see a scenario in which the city of St. Louis ends up with an NFL franchise because you're looking at double digits worth of billions and the value of a franchise is $2 billion. It's just basic economics. And Jim said that it's not that big of a deal. There've been teams in St. Louis at two different junctures in history, and it is a viable market. It's a market that has a tremendous amount of fervor for football. And football, in one way or another, will come back to St. Louis and the National Football League. And this suit may be the pathway to accomplishing that.
We discussed it really at the end of the podcast, but St. Louis is a city that is one of the most, and we're not just saying this, people, Dan, you and I are from New York. You have residents in Florida. You're over in Russia. So you have your fandoms all over the place. You know, I'm a San Francisco Giants fan. I think anybody that follows sports knows that St. Louis is one of the most passionate fan bases. You look at Busch Stadium, right? Even now, the Cardinals, at least at the time of this podcast, are not losing any games. You know, they've won one number of games straight. Now they're in the thick of the playoff race. St. Louis Blues games are completely rocking. It's a question of, you know, how many markets in the country could support a team and want a team. So Jim said it, we didn't say it, that there's been economists that have looked at this and said, hey, 48 teams could be in the NFL and they'd be fine. You know, maybe we're not at that point where we're that close to an issue, right? Maybe you can't have 34 teams, or maybe you could have 36 teams And maybe there are four markets that are ready, willing, and able to take on a team. So, you know, I mean, Jim's got us thinking differently. I know you and I had originally thought relocation was impossible. That was just kind of a pipe dream. But if Jim is saying it, and Jim's been on both sides of the NFL line, with the NFL and going against the NFL, he's someone you have to listen to.
Well, let's see if we're all right. But I like the city of St. Louis's chances in the Missouri state court system. And I think the Oakland Raiders lawsuits are going to be back on track, at least in the federal court system. So the NFL is going to have to, you know, deal with both of these cases on the merits at some point very soon, certainly in Missouri in January. And in the city of Oakland case, that could end up going to trial at some point in 2023 if this decision gets reversed, like I think we expect it to if you watch the oral argument. So never-ending battles over relocation.
Well, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure you rate, review, and subscribe to Conduct Detrimental. As we mentioned, this is really our second St. Louis Rams relocation episode, but we do plan to cover this early and often. We have another episode, we'll say it's a special guest, but it's someone that's been covering the story very closely within St. Louis. So we heard the outcries. Dan, we had such a great episode. And there's people that nitpick and they say, well, you need to have someone on from St. Louis to cover the Rams perspective. Little did they know, we've planned all along to have guests from the city of St. Louis. So yeah, if you're into our show, make sure you follow and make sure you don't miss an episode. We cover obviously all aspects of the St. Louis Rams relocation case, as well as everything and everything at the intersection of sports and law. For Dan and myself, I am at Sports Law Lost on social media. Dan Wallach is at Wallach Legal. The show is at Con Detrimental. And we are covering this story as well on our website, conductdetrimental.com. If you have any interest in writing, if you happen to be an attorney based in St. Louis and feel very passionate about this topic, or if you're just a resident of St. Louis and you want to write about this topic, our website is open to anyone and everyone that wants to write about sports law. For Dan and myself, we will see you next week on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.